Chapter 2. Machine War. Lord of Iron. Combat Projection. Cord could barely see or hear. Metallic thunder rolled through War Anvil. Every surface was vibrating. The sounds of the engines hammered against the ring of shrapnel and the beat of explosions. He kept his eyes to the ground in front of War Anvil. He was using his own eyes. Infrasight had become useless after the first seconds of engagement. Shapes, shadows, and light crowded his eyes as he tried to keep his gaze steady. He could see a target, could see the chipped chevrons crossing its hull. Thrown, it was close.
Zaid!
He shouted.
Firing!
The gunner replied, and the battle cannon shouted its wrath into the chorus of battle. The shell hit the Iron Warrior's tank square on the front of its left track and ripped down its side. The breech block snapped back in front of Cord. Sasha was already yanking it open, ramming the next shell into its mouth. The Iron Warrior's tank was stewing around, its left track shredding.
Saul, finish it!
He shouted. War Anvil bucked as the Ford demolisher cannon fired. The Iron Warrior's tank vanished in a plume of rolling fire. Cord was already pulling his eyes from the forward sight, glancing down at the cracked screen of the Auspex. It was a mess. Runes and tactical markers swarmed through distortion. His regiment still held together, but only just. They had taken some hits, but were still pressing forward. However, their eastern flank had been struck from the side and ripped in two. Its lead vehicles were wrecks, and those behind them were bottling up as they tried to get around their dead comrades. From the moment they had fired the first shells, the assault plan had started to fall apart. The ruins of what had been the Sapphire City, now an irregular plateau of debris, had welcomed them with mines, concealed tank snares, heavy weapon fire, and counter-assault groups ready and waiting. They had not even made the second waypoint yet. The second wave was coming up behind them hard, and they were running out of space. They should have been within a kilometre of the sightless Warren's outer entrances by now. They were nowhere near that close. 10 minutes from the first shot, and the attack looked like a disaster.
"Bastards knew we were coming!"
Sasha shouted, as though she had read his thoughts. She yanked the handle of the breech block down and it slammed shut. Zaid was already traversing the cannon. Cord could hear the gunner swearing into the vox without pause. All of War Anvil's other weapons were firing, sponsons whipping energy out into the chaos. Saul would be dragging another shell into the demolisher's maw. Something hit the back of the hull. Cord's eyes flicked to the runes identifying his regiment's machines. Claw and Razor should have dropped back to cover War Anvil's rear arc. He saw Claw's rune fade out, the heat of its death blooming across the Auspex screen.
"Claw's out!"
Arrigo's voice cracked across the vox from the remaining scout.
"Enemy machines to our rear!"
"Understood,"
replied Cord. For a second he closed his eyes. This attack was dead and done, and now it was just a matter of what the price was and who paid it.
"Bring us around fast!"
he yelled.
"Fire on all targets!"
Haren struck the tank's side plating with his right fist. The armor plates twisted. Pistons in his arm and legs rammed his weight forward and heaved the side of the tank up. Its tracks churned. Dry dust and rubble fragments spun through the air. Its turret tried to turn, pointlessly, desperately. Haren slammed his other fist up into the track. His hand clamped shut, and the drilled teeth on the end of each finger spun to life. The tracks shattered, metal links churning out as the drive wheels kept turning. The tank began to skid away, its other tracks digging into the ground. He triggered the melter guns in the palms of his fists. The tank's armor glowed from red to white. Molten metal ran like spilled blood over Haren's fists. Then the melter jets hit a fuel line, and the top and side of the tank blew out and up in a glowing wet spray. Haren cut the melter weapons and stepped back. The tank crashed back down to the ground, turret pivoting around like a head on a broken neck. He stepped back, fire washing over him. The tank was still. Flames roaring out of its split hull, soot spreading across its corpse. The sky above turned to white brilliance. His senses fizzed, his view dimming. He paused, twisting to look upwards as the sheet of light faded into glowing streaks. Gods of metal stood above him, their shapes shrouded by fog and firelight. Plough-fronted heads swayed beneath backs bent by weapons. They stepped forward as one, and within the fluid of his sarcophagus, Arend thought his remaining flesh trembled. The titans fired again, and again the sky became a blank sheet and the ground a frozen tableau. The stilled tongues of fires licked the mangled corpses of tanks. The shapes of battle automata and dreadnoughts strode or fell or burned. Tanks tumbled or ground forward, the spray and dust of their track clouds frozen in the moment of vanishing. Overlapping explosions blossomed and blurred together. Flare shells burst high above, scattering motes of blinding light. Smoke blended with the patches of remaining night. A shell or fuel cell detonated inside the wreck of the dead tank beside him. Shrapnel pinged against his body and limbs. He felt nothing. Not the ring of the sharp fragments against his iron skin, nor the gouges left as bright scars on his body, nor the heat of the burning tank. Iron without, iron within. Cold, unyielding, unliving. His world was a gunsight view washed with data, his feeling the cold feedback from servos. He took a step, and the pistons of his limbs responded. Voices washed across the vox channels. He saw one of the Sicarans in his group slew around a wreck, turret turning and its cannon thumping shells into the distance. Oran and Gortan were close to him, though he could not see them. Threat runes began to bloom in his sight as the enemy's second wave hit the ruin of the first. He began to run. Piston shortened and rammed down. A predator in streaked white broke from the bright fog. Two hunter missiles loosed from his shoulders even as the recognition formed in his mind. White Scar's Fifth Brotherhood. The predator's cannon twitched towards him. The missiles hit the turret collar and ripped it from the hull in a blazing plume. Arend kept running into the embrace of destruction and felt nothing. Why are you here? Argonis listened as his words drained into the silence of the throne room. Perturabo's black eyes glittered back at him from pits sunken into the Primarch's skull. At the foot and sides of the throne, the still shapes of Perturabo's iron circle automatons stood unmoving, shields held before them. Only Forex stood at his lord's side, the only triarch or senior iron warrior present. Behind Argonis, Sota Nul swayed, the black mesh of her robes rustling on the floor. He heard her triocular lenses whir as they refocused. A step further back, Prophesius was utterly still in his green silk shroud, his breath a low hiss from behind his eyeless iron mask. Perturabo's silence extended. Argonis fought to maintain his gaze under the pressure of the Lord of Iron's presence. The Primarch and his first captain had changed from when Argonis had seen them last. Forex seemed diminished, shrunken in presence, if not in size, the twinkle of malice in his eyes replaced by emptiness. Perturabo himself seemed both more and less than he had been. His flesh had thinned on his bones, and the light clung to recesses of his skull in a way that Argonis's eyes could not read. The Logos, the Lord of Iron's war armor, was lost beneath the pistons and struts of black iron and brushed plasteel. His head nested in a mass of cables and metal tubes. In places, the Primarch's skin seemed to have grown over the implants. Argonis noted the weapons bonded to the armor's arms in bulbous clumps.
"I do not answer to you, emissary," said Perturabo at last, his voice a measured rasp of steel.
Argonis did not flinch.
"You answer to the War Master, and I am his emissary."
"And that is why my brother sent you here, to ask why I am here."
Argonis heard the edge in the words. He inclined his head, half in deference and half in acknowledgement.
"You sit above a dead world, pouring the strength of your legion into its belly.
You call our allies to you and spend them in battles without end or purpose. Your war master wishes to know why.
You speak so, said Forex.
He raised an armored finger and pointed it at Argonis as though it were the barrel of a gun.
Our commitment to Horus is beyond question.
Our lord, the lord who holds your fealty and oaths, speaks and asks as he pleases. Argonis looked up at the bronze and ruby eye which capped the black pole in his hand. And here and now, I am his voice. Forex's mouth opened, but Perturabo's eyes twitched, and the first captain fell silent.
I will be at my brother's side when the gates of our father's realm fall. I will break Terra's defenses at his command and stand beside him when the false Imperium is cast to the flames. Nothing and no one can prevent that.
That is not an answer. Perturabo turned his head slowly, his gaze settling on the dark at the edges of his throne room.
This world was a vital base during the Crusade. The alignment of warp routes that spread from it, and the capacity and resilience of its shelters mean that if it is not ours, then it will be used by our enemies. There are many routes to the throne world, emissary, each one guarded by worlds such as this. The end of this war will not be won just by strength or numbers, but by who controls those gates to terror.
The Lord of Iron paused and rotated his gaze back to Argonis.
This is one such gate, and I will deliver it to the War Master.
The forces you have gathered
are what is required.
Argonis held the Primarch's stare, but felt the chill spread through him under that gaze. It was like being submerged in ice. It was like standing in the presence of Horus Lupercal. After a second, he bowed his head low, taking care to ensure that the banner remained upright. I will remain, Lord, said Argonis, taking care that his tone held defense, respect, and strength, and watch the conclusion of this endeavor. Perturabo inclined his head a fraction.
As you wish.
The doors to the throne chamber began to grind open at an invisible signal. Argonis straightened and walked from the room, the banner of the War Master held in his hand. Sota Nul and Prophesius followed in his wake. As soon as the doors began to grind shut behind him, he clamped his helm over his head. Sota Nul's dry cog voice filled his ears as she spoke over the short-range vox. The signal was encrypted, and the tech witch had sub-vocalized her words.
You were not satisfied, convinced, with the fourth Primarch's answer-response.
Argonis kept looking ahead, kept walking. Iron warriors watched him pass, eyepieces coal red in the low light. The sound of his footsteps seemed to echo as they walked down the wide passage.
Send the signal, he replied after a second.
And let's see what Alpharius's asset knows. Io's world narrowed in the instant it took her to hit the floor. The feeling of her body had vanished, the sensations of her flesh flattened to data sorted by her subconscious. Her kind were created as weapons, as murderers and executioners, but they did those deeds from a distance. They were not Eversaw, or Calidus, or even Culexus. Vanus killed like gods, without ever having to hold the blade or touch the blood. The problem space of combat was uncomfortably small, the variables too fine and too easily misjudged. It was messy, it was inelegant, wasteful, but occasionally necessary. The blur-suited shapes were moving too fast to track. That did not matter. Reaction was not the way of the Vanus Temple. Prediction was everything. The stink of ionizing air was thick in her nose. Data. Three weapons, energy-based, Volkite 93% likely. Cycle from charge to fire, 0.03 seconds. She came up from her role. Projection. Adversaries' training and conditioning will mean that they anticipate target movement prior to firing. She twisted and dropped flat to the floor. Limbs splayed like a spider. Two red pulses of energy cut the air where she would have been.
Data. One adversary still to fire.
Her muscles bunched. Projection. Shot held in case other two adversaries missed. Clever, stroke competent, stroke dangerous. She leapt off the floor with a single snap of muscle. The volkite beam struck the floor and exploded a circle of rockcrete to dust. She twisted as she flew through the air. Her hands grabbed the edge of the still-open vent hatch.
Projection. Other exits from ventilation shafts compromised.
She yanked herself into the air duct.
Data. Corridor door, 20 meters away, currently sealed, only viable exit.
She could hear the soft, swift sounds of the figures in the corridor beneath her. Her hand had already slipped into a pouch and found the small, smooth sphere.
Projection. There is no way of escape while they live.
The grenade was of alien manufacture, rather than human. Its surface was smooth, like ground bone, and it always seemed the same temperature as her skin when she touched it. Never warmer, never cooler. Where it had come from was data that she had not been given. She knew only what it would do when it detonated. That knowledge was enough. Io dropped the grenade through the hatch, and she pulled her body into the vent space.
Data, 1 second since grenade release.
A beam vaporized the edge of the hatch. A blast of heat washed over her, the skin of her face charred and blistered.
Data, 2 seconds since grenade release.
The grenade detonated with a sound like countless needles scraping metal.
Data. Silence. Projection. Adversaries eliminated.
She snapped the visor back over her eyes and blinked her way to the netfly feeds from the corridors around her current position. Empty, or at least they seemed so. An increased error stroke subversion factor now had to be applied to all direct data inputs. The compressed awareness of combat was fading. The skin of her face was severely burned. Her hands were cut to the bone and she was bleeding. She needed to move. A clock began to count in her consciousness.
Count. 2 seconds since enemy asset elimination.
She slid out of the damaged vent hatch and hung beneath it for a heartbeat. The corridor space was red. A thick jelly of pulped flesh covered the walls and ceiling. Hard objects lay amongst the wetness. Her eyes found the grenade, its shape glossed with blood. The monofilament strands, which had exploded from its surface, had withdrawn beneath its eggshell casing. A flick of her eyes identified, dismissed, and then selected other objects from the flesh soup.
Count. 5 seconds.
She swung down and landed with a small splash. She picked up the grenade, then made two quick steps to pluck up a trio of what looked like implanted comms units. A calculated jump took her to the edge of the spreading pool of blood. She stripped to the overalls she had been wearing and stepped from them without losing her stride. Beneath, she was a matte black statue from the neck down, the pouches bonded to the sin skin, breaking the outline of her muscles across her back.
Count, 11 seconds. Projection, 9 to 15 seconds until enemy aware of asset loss.
She began to run. This was going to be messy, but there was no other available path to take. She was under direct threat, and that meant that the possibility of total mission failure was very real.
Count, 13 seconds.
The sealed door from the corridor into the rest of the shelter was in front of her. The visor was projecting the scene from an expanding sphere of rooms and passages around her as her net flies repositioned to form a shell around her.
Count, 14 seconds.
The net fly on the other side of the door caught movement as a figure stepped into the corridor beyond. She took in the field overalls of the sectarnal Regency Guard, the rank pins and status implants around the eyes. An officer, mid-grade, support echelon. She had no idea if he was what he seemed, and at that moment it was irrelevant. The corridor she stood in was filled with the liquidized remains of 3 Alpha Legion operatives, and there was only one way out. The projections indicated that survival was a low probability.
Count, 16 seconds.
She opened the door, rammed it wide, and burst through it at a run. The Regency Guard officer turned at the noise, his mouth opening. Her hand came up, and the digi-needler on her third finger spat a sliver of crystallized toxin into the roof of his mouth. He began to fall. Released air sighed from between his teeth. If anyone but a very, very highly trained and suspicious specialist examined the dead officer, they would conclude that he had died from a sudden massive heart attack. She ran past his corpse.
Count, 19 seconds.
The other Alpha Legion operatives would likely clean up the remains of their dead comrades. They had no interest in alerting the Loyalists that there was a silent war being fought in their midst. A corridor of blood would cause as many problems for them as it would for Io. That, at least, was what the projections said. That was what should happen. That was the best outcome. She needed to leave the Crescent Shelter complex. She needed to get out, link back into her sources of data, and find a weapon to take her enemies down. Count. 23 seconds. Projection. Enemy aware of asset loss. 78% probability. She ducked into a small room and wrenched up a rusted grate set into its floor. A long, dark space looked back at her. She would see this execution completed. But now she needed to run. Count. 26 seconds. Projection. Enemy aware of asset loss. 99% probability. She let out a measured breath and dropped into the waiting dark.